quorum as of yet, but we've got a lot of work to do today, and so we're going to move forward and with some of our agenda items, and then we'll officially call the meeting to order and make motions once we have a quorum in the room. Ms. Bott will note the roll. We are going to hear first from Representative Powell. He's bringing House File 3094 before the committee, and once we get a quorum, we will move your bill and your amendment, but if you'd like to explain it to those that are here, we would appreciate it.
Very good, Madam Chair, committee members. I also have an oral amendment to the bill that we should probably take note of and that you can move when you have a quorum.
Okay, would that be to the bill or the amendment?
To the bill.
And could you tell me what that would be?
Page 1, line 6, instead of $785,000, we'll make it $430,000.
Okay. And is that the only oral amendment?
Yes, it is, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you.
Automatic external defibrillators are the definitive treatment for many causes of cardiac arrest. It is exceedingly important that all public safety personnel have quick access to these devices. The money in this bill will go to the State Patrol for acquisition.
President Powell, if I might, if you were having conversations, if you take them outside the room, please, we would appreciate it. Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The money in this bill would go to the State Patrol for acquisition of enough AEDs to supply each of their vehicles. And I have with me Bradley Peterson from American Heart Association. This is their initiative. If there are any questions, he is here to answer them.
Thank you. Representative Powell, Mr. Peterson, would you like to add a few comments?
Well, I'd just like to, Madam Chair, thank the committee for hearing this bill and reinforce the important life-saving component of this. When somebody goes into sudden cardiac arrest, their chances of survival decrease by 7 to 10% for every minute that they're in sudden cardiac arrest without defibrillation. Nationwide statistics on surviving is between 5 and 6%, so it is relatively low, and early defibrillation is the key to survival.
All right, thank you. And members, you might notice in the A061202 amendment, what we're doing with that amendment is instead of using trunk highway funds, we'd use general funds, and the intent is to amend this bill in committee, and at this point we do have a quorum, so I will officially call the meeting to order, ask that Ms. Lott note the roll. The next item on our agenda is approval of the minutes from Tuesday, March 21st. Are there any additions to those minutes? Corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The minutes are approved. At this point, I'd like to move House File 3094 to be considered by the committee, and as requested by the bill author, an oral amendment to the bill, which would be page 1, line 6, delete $785,000 and insert $430,000. Are there any questions regarding that oral amendment? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Powell, the reason for downgrading your number? I didn't quite catch that.
Representative Powell.
Representative Anderson. When this was first brought to me, this was a rough estimate. I gave the advocates a couple leads on where they could go to get a better number, and this is a better number. It's just a better price.
Okay. For the
thank you. Thank you. Any additional questions on the oral amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion is approved. Next item we'd like to take up is A061202 amendment, which would delete the funding from the Trunk Highway Fund and insert the general fund, and following, if this amendment passed, the bill would be referred to the Public Safety and Finance Committee. Are there any questions on the 1202 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The amendment is adopted. Is there anything you'd like to add, Representative Powell?
Only that, Madam Chair and committee members, that Trunk Highway Fund money for this probably wasn't a very good idea to begin with. This should be a general fund expenditure. So I would appreciate if we could refer back to public safety and let that committee handle the request.
All right, thank you. Is there anybody in the audience that would like to speak for or against the bill as amended? Seeing none, are there any additional questions from committee members? Seeing none, I'll renew my motion that House File 3094, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion is adopted. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Next item on our agenda is House File 3287, Representative Feard. The intent for this bill is that it would be heard and laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Transportation Bill. Welcome to the committee, Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Joining me here today as we present this small request is Mr. Ray Strege from Short Elliott Hendrickson, aeronautical consultant who has long experience with the State Airports Fund and the program. As you recall, during the budget crunch of a couple years ago, $50 million was moved from the aeronautics account into the general fund. Members, those are funds that are collected from user fees that are to be spent on aviation infrastructure in the state. Of course, with things being as they were, it was appropriate to take any uncommitted cash from anywhere, which was fine. It was just a prudent thing to do. The money is already in statute to be put back July 1st of 2007. However, there are some things going on that necessitate us to talk about how much to put back this year yet. With the bankruptcies of five airlines, that's taken quite a toll on the receipts of the aeronautics fund, since there are three major areas that the aeronautics fund receives money from, one being fuel tax revenue, the other being flight line property. The flight line property taxes, fees that are involved in bankruptcy, total about $4.8 million. Then, of course, there's the $15 million we took from the surplus account. There's about $1 million a year of investment revenue that's not being realized. And members, the reorganization plans that are coming out, particularly from Mesaba and Northwest, look like there's going to be a reduction not only in flights, but in the size of the airplanes being flown, which is going to result in lower fuel consumption, which is also going to diminish, quite probably, the fuel tax to be collected in the next 12 months. The governor, I'm very pleased to see, did recommend a $3 million advance to, from the general fund. This is money from the general fund back to the airports fund. We're asking that we make an additional $2 million contribution to $5 million. And to explain why that would be important, Madam Chair, I'd like to ask my first testifier, Mr. Greg Strege, if he could talk a little bit about that.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Strege. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
I'm Ray Strege from Short Elliott Hendrickson. And the two revisions we'd like to see to the legislation from the governor is, first of all, the repayment of $5 million versus $3 million in fiscal year 2007. And then the second would be the date of the initial partial repayment. As in Representative Beard's bill from, as shown as July 1st, 2006, first day of fiscal year 2007, the other bill calls for repayment by June 30th of 2007, so that just moves it up one day for the $3 million, which, depending upon the position of the Department of Finance, may not do anything for the fund. You see in the handouts there the contributions that the State Airports Fund makes to development of airports in Minnesota. What's not shown there is the leverage that this fund enables for getting federal funds. I have three examples of airports. The 2000-2001 State or St. Cloud Regional Airport runway reconstruction and expansion, along with the taxiway and apron, that total project was $17.3 million. The federal share was $14.5 million, state was $700,000, and the local was $2.1 million. But in the course of that project, initially FAA did not agree with the need for the full project. The state stepped in and committed to funding on a state-local basis the remainder of the project. It allowed the project to move forward. The environmental assessment was approved. Necessary permits were obtained. Project was bid and under construction. And About half year after construction started, the last $2 million of federal funding came forward. So even though there was only, I shouldn't say only, but $700,000 of state funds in this, it did enable a $17 million project to move ahead. Last year, there was a runway extension project bid and contract awarded. The construction will occur this year at International Falls for accommodating the new regional jets with Northwest Airlink to that community. Once again, the Federal Aviation Administration did not agree with the need for the entire extension. The Aeronautics Office stepped in, committed to paying on a state-local basis for the last 400 feet of the extension. Finally, when after the jets were on the schedule, Northwest Airlines schedule, FAA decided, yes, we do need the full length, and they committed to that. So that was a $4 million project. $3.8 million of that is federal funding, all from aviation users, both at the federal and the state level. This is all aviation user funding. Local contribution was $200,000, and all the airports fund out of this $4 million project is $17,000. But it enabled a $4 million project to go ahead. Right now we have bids in hand for the Red Wing Airport, a much smaller project, about $710,000. We have $311,000 of Federal Aviation Administration money available, but we do need a state match of approximately $270,000 for that. That project is on hold until there is state funds available. So we would recommend that the bill presented by Representative Beard be approved by the committee. Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Beard, I see you have four additional testifiers, and you have 5 minutes, so I'll leave it up to you.
Madam Chair, I'm going to call three of them down here for about 1 minute of endorsement apiece, if I may.
All right,
first,
thank
I'd like to call Mr. Glenn Burke, the president of the Minnesota Council of Airports, and right behind him I'd like to have Mayor David Pleiss from St. Cloud.
Thank you. Any questions at this time from committee members? All right, seeing none, welcome to the committee, sir. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
My name is Glenn Burke. I'm the chairman of the Minnesota Council of Airports and the manager of South St. Paul Airport. Madam Chair, members of the Transportation Finance Committee, the bill that Representative Beard has placed in front of you will allow the airport fund to move along, and one thing that we are worried about is that with the bankruptcy of the airlines and the reduction in schedules, that the funds that are now in the are accounted for or estimated to come through may not come through, and if this money that the full $5 million would allow the fund to continue in full operation throughout the remainder of this budget cycle.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Seeing none, thank you, sir.
Thank you. Mayor Kleiss, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mayor Kleiss. Nice to see you back.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had to actually get out of the legislature so I could come to the House committee. I've always enjoyed the ability to do that, so I appreciate the opportunity.
And if I might have you state your name for the record.
Dave Kleiss, so Mayor of the City of
Thank
St. Cloud. Madam Chair, I'm here to be in strong support of House File 3287, Representative Beard's bill. For St. Cloud, our purpose, as was mentioned earlier, runway extension could not have happened without that. We also had our air traffic control tower would not have happened without that state share. It would have went forward, and that's as a matter of public safety. Got back from last week, a couple of days lobbying our congressional delegation, and to a member. One of their big issues is that state commitment. This fund, obviously, one of the biggest aspects of the federal funding for airports is having that state commitment. We've had a tremendous amount of local share of commitment in this, but without that state funding and without this fund, and particularly the user fee that this is, it's been a huge asset for our area and all airports across the state. So I'm just here in strong support of House File 3287.
Thank you very much, Mayor. Are there any questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, the President of the Minnesota Business Aviation Association, Mr. David Clark. For those of you with David Clark headsets, yes, that really is his name.
Welcome to the committee, sir, if you'll state your name for the record.
Dave Clark, and I'm actually the vice president of the Minnesota Business Aviation Association. We're an association that was founded 50 years ago, and today we have over 350 members in the state of Minnesota, representing every facet of corporate aviation in our state. We're here to support the House File 3287. There's a number of companies outstate Minnesota that use airports, and both companies outstate and in Minneapolis, Twin Cities area. Schwann's, Cargill, St. Paul Travelers, and General Mills, these companies own and use business aircraft. They pay aircraft registration fees, and they also pay aviation fuel taxes as well. The MBA members and the companies they work for use Minnesota's aviation system. We rely on our state airports to be maintained at the highest level for safety and for construction projects to be completed in a timely manner. I urge the members of the Transportation Finance Committee to pass House File 3287, which will enable Minnesota to maintain its excellent aviation system and to be a magnet for economic growth.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. Is there anybody in the audience that would like to speak in opposition to this bill? And Representative Beard, do you have any closing comments?
I do, Madam Chair, and they'll be concise and brief. Members, there actually are two parts to the bill. First of all is, again, to express appreciation for the $3 million of the governor's supplemental budget. The folks that are actually on the ground in the airports making the aviation infrastructure in this state work are of the opinion that that's shaving it just a little too close. On a $21 million annual budget, we're projecting a $700,000 cash carry forward at June 30th of next year. Anything goes amiss on the projections for flightline property tax or fuel, and we're pretty sure they will, that's going to put us in a situation where the Commissioner of Finance is going to have to close the checkbook for the Department of Aeronautics, which is going to, I think, unnecessarily jeopardize projects that are contracted or about to be so. I'd appreciate your consideration, your support of this bill. The second part that's important, Madam Chair, is that the Governor's appropriation does ask that the money be put there by June 30th of 07. And I think it would be prudent if we put it there July 1st of 06. So it was actually money, cash on hand, ready to go, so nothing was delayed. Thank you. I stand for any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions of Representative Beard? All righty. And with that, we will lay House File 3287 on the table for possible inclusion in the transportation omnibus bill. Thank you very much, Representative Beard. And we have had we've had some guests join us today. We have students from the St. Louis Park High School visiting us. Welcome. We're glad that you're here. And we're going to start a bill that's going to talk about eminent domain and when government can take personal property from individuals. Representative Abrams.
Madam Chair, I'm a 1970 graduate of Park High, so if you don't watch yourselves, you may end up at the table rather than in the audience.
And Representative Abrams, would you like to sing their school song? Representative Johnson, we're ready for you. Representative Hausman.
The question for the previous bill, do we have a sense of will our committee, in fact, have a target that there will potentially be a bill that will be moving forward?
They are still working on the target situation and the structure of what the bills will look like, but I was told to hold it over. If for some reason we won't have an omnibus bill or a targeted committee, at that time we will be happy to move his bill to the appropriate committee, whether it be Ways and Means or another committee that will be dealing with those appropriations. Welcome to the committee, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
My understanding is that you'd like about 10 minutes to present your bill with some testifiers. We have some people who would like to testify in opposition. We have a number of amendments. It's my intention to finish this bill today, and we do not have a room reserved for after session, so we will move quite rapidly through amendments after we go through the bill. In addition, Mr. Walls is for the second time copying a fiscal note, and we'll take a little time on that as well. So if you'd like to explain your bill to the committee.
And Madam Chairman, do you just want me to touch on the three areas that I think have a transportation impact and that the amendments apply to?
That would be great. And I think the number of the committee members have heard this bill in other committees, and certainly if there are additional questions outside of those sections, I know you'd be more than prepared to address them, but in the interest of time, we'll try and concentrate on those areas that have a direct influence in our jurisdiction.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Then I will do that, and I'm not even going to give any introductory remarks. We'll just jump right into the bill. If you turn to page 4, section 4, starting on 4.24, that is the attorney fee provision in the bill. And in essence, what that says is that if a property owner challenges a government taking by eminent domain and wins, the government has to pay the property owner's attorney's fees. And a win can happen in one of two ways. Either a court can find that the government did not have a right to take the property at all because it wasn't a public use, or in the case of a road or a highway, for example, where it clearly is a public use, a win would be considered the property owner obtaining 20% more than what the final written offer of the government was. So what we are trying to do in cases like this is discourage those situations of lowballing that do occur, and I don't believe that they happen every day, and they're not rampant, but they certainly occur, and I've heard from plenty of people across the state of Minnesota who have told me that they do. What this will do will provide some disincentive to that and allow a property owner who has been wronged to not have to suffer the financial consequences. If then you turn to page 5, section 7, line 5.21, that is compensation for loss of going concern. And what that provision says is that if a piece of business property is taken and destroyed, so we're not talking about a strip taking here, we're talking about a complete taking, there will be an assumption, essentially, that going concern value will be provided to the property owner. The government has the opportunity to disprove that assumption as it is set out in this particular section, but the assumption will be that this provision creates a burden upon the government to show that the property owner should not get going concern for the destruction of their business property. Currently, the law is the opposite. The burden is upon whenever, it's seldom offered or given, but in order to get it, the burden is certainly upon the property owner, and we think it should be the other way around. And then the last piece that I believe there may be an amendment or two on is on page 6. Line 6.10, this is an amendment that was added in the last committee regarding compensation for loss of access. And what the author of that amendment, Representative Heidrichen, was trying to get at was if a business, and the example given was a gas station, through some street or highway changes loses more than half of their access points or driveways into their business, and they can also show that they lose more than half of their income or revenues in the following year and can connect the two, that will be treated as a taking. Madam Chairman, I think those are the three pieces that probably would interest your committee the most.
All right, thank you. And according to my information, you have three people that would like to testify on behalf of your bill?
Yes.
All right. I have Mr. Rolnick, Mr. Zander, and Ms. Parson.
That's right.
You might decide who...
Mr. Rolnick would be first. That would be fantastic.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Rolnick.
Members, I'm Arthur Rolnick. I'm the Director of Research at the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, and I'm here to talk about a framework for you to think about eminent domain, talk about the economics of eminent domain. Last summer, as you may know, in the so-called Kelo ruling, the U.S. Supreme Court affirmed the power of government to take private property from one citizen and give to another to promote job creation and economic development. The ruling, as you probably know also, ignited a nationwide firestorm of protest by defenders of property rights. Opponents of the High Court ruling do not object when the power of eminent domain is used to promote the building of goods that serve the community at large, such as schools and roads and parks, libraries, reducing pollution and blight. These are good economists call public goods. But the opponents of the High Court ruling do object to the taking of private property from one citizen to give to another citizen. They object even if it promotes job creation and economic development because such takings undermine property rights, and property rights are a keystone of our economic success and our society at large. This afternoon, I want to argue that the case against the Kelo ruling is even stronger than the one made by the defenders of property rights. I want to argue that not only are the costs of the Kelo ruling potentially very high, that is, the cost of undermining property rights, but the public benefits are illusory. Indeed, allowing state and local officials to engage in such activities, taking from one private citizen and giving to another, does not promote economic development. It actually diminishes it. So let me quickly review the Kelo decision and go into the economic arguments. In the Kelo decision, the Supreme Court saw no difference between private developments that are deemed by state and local officials to serve a public purpose and public goods. Let me quote Justice John Paul Stevens, who wrote for the majority. And I quote, "Promoting economic development is a traditional and long accepted function of government. There is, moreover, no principled way of distinguishing economic development from other public purposes that we have recognized," unquote. The majority view on economic development, as expressed by Justice Stevens, in all due respect, is mistaken. While clearly government has a critical role in promoting a sound economy, its role is well contained. Modern economic theory and research shows that government should not interfere in most market transactions. Indeed, contrary to Justice Stevens' claim, modern theory says that government can distinguish between economic development and public goods, and that the government should not interfere in the former. So to understand why economists would make this argument, it's very important to understand this concept of a public good. Public good are what economists call non-rival goods. The standard textbook example is a lighthouse. Once that light is out there, any ship can see the light, use it to its advantage, and it doesn't affect the consumption of the rest of the ships. National defense is another obvious one. You can think of education as components of public goods. That's why we have government underwriting a lot of education. In fact, I'd like to cite John Adams in the first written constitution in this country. For the state of Massachusetts, he required the state to educate its children because we know educated kids and educated adults lead to better democracy. So we know what public goods are. There's a problem with a public good in when you need to build a school or a firehouse and you need to take a private property is what's called the holdup problem. The person owning that property can take advantage of the government there and charge an exorbitant amount for that property. And so over the years, we've agreed that the use of eminent domain in this case, even though it does affect property rights, the benefits outweigh the costs. What about private goods, those goods that are rival goods? Well, economists have a long literature on the theory, starting with Adam Smith, that we know that the private sector on its own, the invisible hand, will lead to a very efficient system. It's not just theory. Take a look at those countries since World War II that have been so successful. They're all been driven by market-based economies. The most interesting example today is China, which has now moved to a market-based economy, and they're developing into one of the most successful economies in the world. But I want to give you some very specific cases of the use of eminent domain that should illustrate that the government shouldn't be involved. I want to give two in particular, one from my hometown, Detroit. In 1981, using eminent domain, the city of Detroit demolished over 1,100 buildings, including 140 businesses and three schools, at the cost of over $200 million to clear the way for General Motors to build a new auto plant. The city expected the facility to employ 6,000 people, lift the economic fortunes of Pole Town neighborhood and eastern Detroit. The plant never employed as many people as GM promised it would. In 1986, 2,500 were laid off. Today, Pole Town is in decline. Today, vacant and burned out buildings line the area's once busy commercial strip. Cincinnati, likewise, in an attempt to use eminent domain to establish upscale department store downtown, the city of Cincinnati failed in the late 1980s in the course of a complicated land swap undertaken to accommodate a Nordstrom store. The city bulldozed several small businesses, but Nordstrom's ultimately declined to build on the site, and the city eventually converted it into a municipal parking lot. Other examples of condemnations that yielded questionable economic benefits abound across the country. Now, proponents of the Kilo will say, wait a second.
Well, we've consumed 10 minutes plus on the pro side. There's about two more testifiers.
Okay. Proponents of the Kilo decision would likely say, well, wait a minute, there's examples where it worked out, but be careful. I'll give you I'll conclude with a specific example here in the Twin Cities. This was a Target store, downtown Minneapolis. They used eminent domain. These were two private developers. Opus Corporation owned that land. They were going to develop it. This was not blighted. Ryan wanted that land to build a Target store. The city used eminent domain to take from Opus to give to Kilo. Take from Opus to give to Ryan. The market would have done this on its own. Believe me, Target knows how to make good location decisions. If that was a good location decision, Opus and Ryan would have worked out a deal one way or the other. And if Opus decided that it wasn't worth it, Opus would have built something. Odds are that, again, the market would have gotten it right. So you don't need the government to step into situations like that. So even when it appears to look right, I'm going to argue the use of eminent domain to interfere in private market transactions is counterproductive. So let me just conclude. The opponents, based on property rights, their argument is actually stronger. It's not just that the costs are very high, but the benefits are illusory. This is not what eminent domain should be used for. Government should only appear in the market when it comes to public goods. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions, Mr. Rolnick? Representative Houseman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to put it in the context of some specifics here, a few years ago, the House and Senate voted overwhelmingly in a bill to give an energy firm in northern Minnesota the right to take private property through eminent domain. We specified that. And though I haven't seen it, this is my first time I'm hearing this bill. My understanding is this bill does still carve out, it gives an exception to that one group, that utilities could still take private property. I happen to have a constituent who has a retirement home that is at some risk. How does that fit what you just talked with us about?
Because you
Mr.
have to come
Rolnick.
To, I'm sorry, thank you, Madam Chair. You have to come to grips with is this utility a public good? I think generally we think of utilities as natural monopolies and public goods, and so there is at least a consideration of possibly using eminent domain. But I would use it judiciously. I would make sure that the property, if there is a need, if there's no other property around for expansion, if this is the only property available, then maybe I would use it in that case. But again, I would have the hurdle pretty high. I would want to make sure there's an obvious public purpose, there are no other avenues, and I would make sure there's a fair price being paid in that case.
And would you see, Ms. Madam Chair, would you see then a reason to carve out one part of our business sector in this bill to give them the right?
I might. Again, I would make it clear that this is this committee views this as a public good because it serves the community at large, providing energy in this particular way, and that could be, I wouldn't view it as an exception. Again, I think it's legitimate. It has been for many years in this country to use eminent domain in the case of public goods. So I think it has to be clear it's a public good. I will make a strong argument that a Target store downtown, a Best Buy in Bloomington, in Richfield, is not a public good. Those are clearly private goods. When you get to utilities, when you get to schools and roads and light, then you have a good argument for using eminent domain.
And then, Madam Chair, and again, because I am seeing this for the first time, I don't know if this section was in an original bill, but there is a section, compensation for removal of legal nonconforming use. And as I read that, I thought we're almost now going into the area of zoning. And as an example, a city, I mean, what we say is this noble public good in this bill, government shouldn't take private property through eminent domain. That's an overreaching, that sounds like a good goal. But it almost seems as though if we overreach, that we take away the very tools that a city has to protect property owners from damage to their property values. For example, a city might use that if there's an issue of salvage yards or billboards in awkward places. In rural Minnesota, they might use that for a feedlot. But when we include that in a bill like this, we could potentially take the one tool away that a city has to protect homeowners from blight and from something that will threaten their property values.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think there are other tools that you might want to look at first before you use eminent domain, and I think zoning is a tool to be used to limit blight and to limit the kind of concerns that you have. So, again, I would use eminent domain and taking private property very judiciously, even when it comes to public goods.
So we would want to be sure that we don't interfere with yes. city zoning
I agree.
Opportunities in this.
No. Thank you. Are there any additional questions? Seeing none, I would like Mr. Zander and, I'm sorry, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Rolnick, in the bill, it talks about if the final judgment or award for damages as determined at any level in the eminent domain process or by the parties themselves is more than 20% greater than the last written offer of compensation by the condemning authority, that these attorney fees can be made available to the person that was damaged by it. What about in the case of a public utility? Should that amount of money be within a matter of a certain percent of what the property is worth? Or
that's hard for me to say. Thank you, Madam Chair. It's hard for me to say on the specifics. I would say this, given it is a taking and given there is some coercion there, I would err on the generous side when we take property from private citizens. So you can get a range of what a property is valued. Recognize sometimes, though, what the market is selling a particular property at, what a particular person views their own home or their own business could be much different, and that's why they're not selling. So I would bias the price in favor of the seller when it comes to a public good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Zanders and Ms. Parson, please. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman, member of the committee. My name is John Zander, and I live in rural Janesville, Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. And I thank you for the opportunity to testify in front of the committee today. And I would like to state that I support House File 2846. Minnesota Department of Transportation enjoys the reputation with many Minnesotans as an agency working for the public good. But my experience over 5 years is that Minnesota Department of Transportation can be heavy-handed with little concern about the very residents who MnDOT is demanding give up the property for that public good. As part of a plan to acquire my property, MnDOT gave my brother and myself a low-ball offer, hoping that we would be like those landowners who would not aggressively challenge them. MnDOT was wrong about the facts, and they were wrong to mistreat us the way that they did. I owned an 18-acre parcel in Waseca County along the Dakota, Minnesota, and Eastern Railroad and along Highway 14. At this site, I had access to an all-weather road, railroad service, heavy electrical capacity, and pipeline natural gas. The property was improved with a 24-inch well, a railroad spur track, a truck scale, 40,000 square feet total of buildings, a number of storage silos, 250,000-gallon fuel storage tank, and a 300,000-square-foot parking lot or staging yard. So you'll see the site was well located and well developed for heavy industrial use. After continuous opposition from us over a number of design issues, including environmental damage, MnDOT acquired half of the site by eminent domain in January of 2003, leaving me with a wedge-shaped piece of land with a four-lane highway between me and the railroad. As your map will show, my original property is bounded by the red line. The acquisition, I believe, is bounded by the green line. The building that they have left me now is now a non-conforming structure. The land is essentially unbuildable because of setbacks and wetland. But I'd like to tell you, I was compensated. I was offered $150,000. $150,000 for 9 acres of industrial land, a railroad spur, a 24-inch well, 3,700 square feet of building, a staging area, and my truck scale. And that $150,000 also included severance damage to the remaining property. Specifically, I was offered $2,213 for a 24-inch well that had 70 years of functional life remaining and a replacement cost of $240,000. That's less than 1%. And I ask you, is 1% fair? I was offered $18,000 for a 2,400 square foot cement block building with a loading dock, and that's about what I paid for the roof that I put on it 4 years previous. I was offered $5,500 per acre for land zoned industrial, which is about what my neighbors were paid for farmland. And to drive a loaded semi-truck on bare farmland, you need to add a lot of gravel. On a 300,000 square foot yard, 1 foot of gravel would cost approximately $100,000, and there was 2 feet of gravel on that, according to soil borings.
Mr. Zander, I'm going to have to ask you to move along here, otherwise we're not going to get this bill passed today, and I think that's what you'd like.
I have a number of items I briefly listed on the back of my map that the committee can review, and I'd be happy to answer any questions on those, but then I will forego the rest of my statements to move this along. Thank you very much.
Are there any questions for Mr. Zander? Comment noted.
Madam
Ms. Parsons.
Madam Chair.
I'm sorry, Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question. Mr. Zander, is that correct?
Correct.
Actually, I agree, you've got some problems, but now what's considered in this bill, we're going to change the whole state policy. You may be been abused, but does that mean necessarily everybody's been in the same situation? I get a little problem with that. We're going to make a major change which affects taxpayers' money, and I guess you're a taxpayer and I am. That's my concern. I certainly agree with you, but I'm concerned here we're looking at an isolated instance. There are probably instances where it weren't. I think the commissioners that viewed were not MnDOT employees. They're contract viewers, aren't they? I don't think they're MnDOT employees. So we're saying MnDOT lowballed this, and I'm not sure if MnDOT lowballed it because they hire appraisers. I'm sure they were hired appraisers, and you had a chance to appeal it. And I guess I'm not questioning or arguing with you, but my concern is we're going to be looking at one item here and maybe change the whole ball of wax for everybody else in the state. And I think you've got a reason to be concerned. It doesn't sound as good to me. But my concern is we're dealing with taxpayers' money and a total state project. I just wanted to make that out.
Well, I think we'll have people that will speak in opposition to the bill that will probably enlighten us about other perspectives on the PERP process. Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think, Mr. Zander, as I understand, this has been a long process with Highway 14, and I believe you worked with the county Corps of Engineers and have taken this to court and everything. So I think there's a lot more that goes into this than what is presented here. But I just wanted to make sure that we had a fair appraisal of the situation.
Madam Chair.
Representative Johnson.
Part of the point here is that how much have you spent in attorney's fees so far?
I've spent over $200,000 in attorney's fees.
Mm-hmm.
And should he bear that if he ends up winning? I would say no.
Madam Chair, if I might address the previous question, yes, it was an independent appraiser hired by the Department of Transportation, but it was reviewed and signed off by MnDOT personnel at, I believe, two or even three levels. So it was closely reviewed. Mine is a very blatant example, and that's why I'm here to testify. If you'll talk to many of my neighbors on that project, you talk to many of the people in Rochester, you will see that it's an ongoing pattern. The point is that what is our recourse as private landowners here?
And members, I may caution you, after session, both Representative Johnson and I are working on the data practices omnibus bill starting at 5 o'clock in civil law. If we do not complete this by 2:15, 2:30, we will be back here at 9 or 10 o'clock at night to complete this bill. Ms. Parsons. Welcome to the committee, and I'm sorry that I'm going to have to ask you to keep your comments brief, but if you'll provide your testimony.
I will be as quick as I can. My name is Lori Parsons. I own Lori's Violin Formalware in Cold Spring and have for over 16 years. I am here to tell you just a small portion of what myself, my business, my family, and my customers have had to suffer because MnDOT abuses eminent domain. I was one of the biggest supporters of Highway 23 project when it was in the initial planning process, until I had to experience firsthand the wrath of MnDOT and an eminent domain. Because of improper treatment, my case was dragged out over 5 years. I even tried to get assistance from the Lieutenant Governor's office when dealing with MnDOT and their antics and delays. I could not bear any longer. Sorry, I'm nervous. I feel like a deer in headlights.
Okay, when I heard you ran a bridal shop for 16 years, I thought you could probably put up with anything. But
trust me. If you were in my store, we'd be on even ground. I'm in your house, and I'm not comfortable here. I'm sorry. My MnDOT changed our access. In the initial planning process, we had agreed upon an access that would work for our business. About a year or two later, MnDOT all of a sudden changed this access without my permission or me knowing any of it. This access change has caused several accidents. It has caused my customers to be pulled over by the police because they stop out on the highway because they have no idea how to get to my business. My business was not given proper signage even in the initial construction process of going through this because MnDOT was playing some really not very nice games with us. My neighbors, Golden Plump, and a new car dealership that had just moved in were given great big huge signs. Our store was given none. It took me 6 months to fight with MnDOT to even get signage on the highway to tell people how to come to my store. MnDOT and their staff took my property when they needed it, but in turn dragged out our settlement over a process of 5 years that cost me over $60,000 in attorney's fees and appraisal fees. I'm sorry.
Okay.
MnDOT hired the initial appraiser not only to be happy with his findings, so they exercised their right to hire a second one, which dragged this process out over 500 extra days. There might be some nice people on MnDOT, but I'm telling you, myself, my neighbors, and all of my fellow businesses did not experience anything like this. In the first year of construction, my business suffered over $70,000 in losses. The second year of construction, over $200,000 in losses. The third year, over $32,000 in losses. I received a settlement of $190,000 from MnDOT that was supposed to be fair. I incurred over $300 in business losses in the 3 years of construction, $60,000 in attorney's fees. MnDOT was so unfair to come in and quote me $2,000 to replace my signage out front to tell my customers how to get to me, and it cost me over $11,000 just to replace the sign. I had to change my septic system. I had to suffer the cost and financial burden of that. I am still suffering costs of structural damage that was done to my business, as well as parking lot damage that was done by MnDOT, all of which nothing has ever been incurred. The $190,000 was supposed to cover all of that. My initial plans for my business, I had 2 acres of land. They took over half of it. When they exercised eminent domain, this drug out over 3 years. I even had to pay property taxes on property that the state of Minnesota took from me for 3 years before they filed the proper paperwork, so that I was no longer paying property taxes on land they took from me 3 years prior to that. If you don't support and stand up for us, me, the little guy who doesn't mean much of anything, but you know what? For 16 years, I have given my entire life to that business. Who on earth will? Thank you very much.
Thank you. That's okay. Is there any questions, Ms. Ferguson? All right, thank you very much for coming down. All right, we have a number of people who have asked to testify in opposition to this. Keith Carlson, Mark Manderscheid, Steve Babul, Nancy Schuyler, Nathan Richmond, and Margaret Donahoe. Sir, my understanding is that you were told if, there, if time would allow. So let's take some opposition. We're already twice as much in the pro side that was supposed to be allotted to the committee. Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, I'll forego that.
Thank you. Mark Manderscheid. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
It's Mark Manderscheid. I'm an attorney in private practice. I live in St. Paul. I want to ask you to amend two of the provisions of the bill that is before you. I believe amendment is necessary because I believe the language as drafted will not work.
And so, in other words, do you want to speak to the amendments when they're presented?
I would prefer to clue you into these and then as you do the amendments later on because I don't know which ones you'll be doing at which time.
Okay, but then you will not be coming up during the
amendment. I understand.
Okay, thank you.
The first one is attorney's fees. I represent both private property owners and government entities in eminent domain. I don't have an objection to the government being required to pay attorney's fees if there's a lowball offer. My objection to what the language is twofold. First, it limits the early time period unnecessarily, and second, the percentage is too small. Let me give you an example. I've got a project right now where I'm counsel for the property owner. It's up in Little Canada. MnDOT's offer is $300,000. The appraisal that the property owner has is $1 million. MnDOT has, because we shared with them our appraisal report, agreed to come up to $400,000. Thus, MnDOT's already at the 20% threshold. If this bill were to become law, if that law applied today, I would have absolutely no incentive to settle this case. Since I know MnDOT even agrees that we're already at $400,000, MnDOT made their initial offer. We've already hit the $20,000 or the 20% limit. I might as well go ahead, take the case to trial, see if I can get a really big award because I know my attorney's fees are going to be covered. The people who have been testifying before you talking about lowball offers and many of the other committees were able to identify instances where their numbers were 2, 3, and 4 times the offer of the government. A 20% threshold isn't even in the same league as any of those situations. Value is not an objective fact. Value is a judgmental range. 20% amongst appraisers is nothing. As Mr. Zander identified, he said that MnDOT didn't understand his situation. Oftentimes that's true because government entities don't understand the private property owner's situation. But they have to start somewhere. They start somewhere with an appraisal. They make an offer. I think you should amend this to allow the government to measure the time for attorney's fees at a later point in the process so that if they've come in and recognized the error of their ways, there should be an incentive for them to change. Second, 20% just doesn't work. 20% is too low a number. You will cover all of the situations of a Mr. Zander or a Ms. Parsons or any of the others who have testified by 50% or some other number. Secondly, I want to talk about loss of going concern. Currently in Minnesota, loss of going concern is allowed by case law. The procedure is that the property owner who thinks they have suffered a loss of going concern goes to the district court judge, lays out their case, says, I think I've suffered a loss of going concern. Judge, direct the commissioners to order to allow me to present testimony for loss of going concern. Keep in mind that loss of going concern is defined as a reputation for dependability, skill or quality, customer base, or goodwill. I don't have a problem with defining loss of going concern in statute. It is that way in several states. But nowhere else in the United States is the burden put on the government to disprove the subjective elements of the property owner's own business. In the early stages of a condemnation case, there is no discovery. The government cannot compel the property owner to provide any information. And so for the government to try and dispel whether the property owner has a reputation for dependability, whether customers will follow them, whether they have good service, with no access to tax returns, with no access to financial statements, with no access to any information whatsoever about the business, is an impossibility. I don't disagree that there should be a loss of going concern provision. Some businesses truly are put out of business because of the taking, and they should be able to present a claim, but they should have to prove their own claim. Nowhere else in the civil law is there a situation where the party who bears the burden of proof to make their claim, i.e. the party seeking damages, not the party that has to prove their claim. In personal injury cases and contract cases, the party who wants the money always has to prove their claim. What I'm asking you to do is to simply change a few words in that section, turn it around, keep the same definitions, but say that it is the property owner who must come forward and establish before the district court judge that they have in fact suffered a loss of going concern. If they can establish that in front of the judge, then the judge will direct the commissioners to hear their evidence concerning a loss of going concern damages. Those are my comments on those two issues.
Thank you. Are there any questions for the witness? Seeing none, thank you, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Anderson, you said that 20% is too low. What is your, if you could live in a world that you would like to see as far as this bill, what number would you pick?
I would go with Madam Chair, may I? I would go with the sense that Mr. Johnson said if the property owner wins, they should get compensated. By my measure, winning is coming up with a number that's closer to my dollar figure than it is to the other side. So in the instance I gave you, if the state's number was $300,000 and the private property owner's number was $1 million, those are $700,000 apart, that's $350,000. I would say whoever gets to the property owner can get to $651,000, then they should get all of their attorney's fees reimbursed. You are the Transportation Finance Committee, and what I am concerned about these attorney's fees provisions is that they will prevent settlement. You want to have a bill that puts the incentives so that everyone has a reason why they should want to settle. If the 20% number stays in place, then the property owner no longer has any incentive whatsoever to settle, and you can't settle a case in which one party has no incentive to settle.
Thank you very much. The next person on the list is Steve Vables. And will Commissioner Schuyler come to the table as well? And if the page will grab another chair for the witnesses, that would be appreciated. Mr. Schuyler, you beat the gentleman, so you're up next. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Nancy Schuyler. I'm a Dakota County Commissioner, and I'm also the President of the Association of Minnesota Counties, and my testimony here today is on their behalf. The use of eminent domain is an important tool for counties. It allows counties to respond to community needs to achieve a greater public good. Typically, counties use eminent domain for very traditional purposes, such as road construction and acquiring land for parks and county buildings. The primary use of eminent domain by counties is for right-of-way acquisition for road construction projects. Therefore, my comments are focused on that particular use. Dakota County, as an example, acquires between 200 to 400 parcels of property for right-of-way each and every year. These acquisitions may vary from temporary easements to small strip takings of permanent right-of-way, all the way to full residential and business acquisition. On average, we may acquire 20 to 60 parcels through condemnation proceedings, which means that 85 to 90% of our acquisitions are successfully negotiated, often through the quick take process. Because of tax implications, property owners have actually asked counties to use their power of eminent domain to acquire their land. AMC and its member counties are concerned with the proposed language for awarding attorney's fees. When we are negotiating to acquire right-of-way, we are spending property tax dollars. The payment of attorney's fees will increase the cost of road construction projects. The proposed legislation puts counties at a disadvantage in the negotiation process. The property owner has the advantage of forcing the county to settle at 20% over the appraised value just so the county can avoid the additional attorney's fees. When the county has a disadvantage, the property owner has been incented to hold out for at least that 20%. An additional 20% over the appraised value may seem just and fair to the property owner. It is not just and fair to the property taxpayer. As I stated earlier, many of our right-of-way acquisitions are accomplished through the quick-take process. Knowing of the 20% threshold for settlement is hanging over the county's head, the number of quick-take acquisitions is likely to decrease substantially. Why not require all right-of-way purchases to be 20% over appraised value and leave it at that? No appeals, no attorney's fees. The effect is the same. Property taxpayers will be spending at least 20% more than the appraised value of the property anyway. This is not fiscally responsible public policy. In addition, applying the 20% rule from the time of filing the condemnation petition does not take into consideration the fluctuation of property value over the time it takes the process to be completed. In Dakota County, market values have increased from 6 to 15% in the past year just based on the type of property. Our court system is already backlogged. This legislation will add congestion to the court calendar and cost local property taxpayers more money. At a minimum, an inflation factor should be included so companies don't end up paying attorney's fees when the cost has increased because property values have increased during the time it has taken to settle the price of acquisition. For a better understanding of what these increased costs mean to counties, I will use Dakota County as an example. Over the past 5 years, Dakota County has spent over $14 million to purchase right-of-way for road construction projects. If we use the 20% over appraised value and added that on, it would equate to an additional $3 million, thus making $17 million in road construction expenses for the same five-year period. We will never be able to afford the transportation infrastructure needed when adding 20% to the cost of the project before any construction has actually taken place. To give you an idea of what that 20% could pay for, in the metro area, $1 million will pay for 1 mile of two-lane road or four traffic signals. Without adding on the attorney's fees, we are talking about considerable costs for an already underfunded transportation system. Should the proposed legislation pass, there are a backlog of needs that will grow because the funds won't be available to pay for these additional costs. The loss of going concern language because of closing access points is also problematic to counties. According to my highway engineer, the control of access can greatly reduce congestion and can be more cost-effective than adding lanes to expressways. A change in access doesn't always equate to a change in business. If congestion is reduced, more people may do their business at that location. In addition, there can be many other factors that contribute to the loss of business. Applying a direct percentage of loss of business to access will be very difficult to determine when the other factors may be present. This is a very important piece of legislation. The public perception is of the heavy hand of local government coming down and taking advantage of property owners because we have the power and the authority to use eminent domain. But not every taking of property through condemnation is an abuse of power. And not every unit of government with the power of eminent domain has abused its power. Not one example of this abuse has been attributed to counties in any of the hearings that this bill has had. If the intent of this legislation is to reform the use of eminent domain to address the heavy hand of government when it has abused the process, then I would ask on behalf of the counties of Minnesota for legislation which focuses on fixing that very problem. Please do not pass broad sweeping legislation that will negatively impact the majority in order to rein in those that have abused their authority. It will cause delay in road improvement projects and drive up property taxes. And even with the proposed change of shouts made on awarding of attorney fees, I think we all know that once an attorney is involved, attorney's fees will be included. Please develop sound public policy by focusing your legislation on the problem at hand, those who have abused the power of eminent domain. On behalf of counties, I request the exclusion of county right-of-way acquisition from the burden of attorney's fees and or the additional 20% over appraised value. We aren't trying to be unfair to the property owners. We are just trying to be good stewards of the public's money while addressing the needs of the greater good. Thank you for this opportunity to share the county perspective of this very important issue, and I will respond to any questions.
Any questions? Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I don't know, I think this maybe is to staff, but the fiscal note we have, is there an attempt in a fiscal note to determine impact on property taxes? Do we...
Mr. Walsh.
Madam Chair, Representative Hausman, I think what you could request be done for this bill is a local impact note. The only costs reflected in state in fiscal notes are impacts on state agencies.
And Madam Chair, when we see yes under local, in other words, we're just saying yes, it has, but we didn't measure it.
Mr. Walsh.
Madam Chair, Representative Hausman, if there has been a local impact note done, I have not checked for one. I'm not exactly sure if one has been completed.
Madam Chair.
Representative Abrams.
Madam Chair, the usual process, either the chair of the tax committee or the ranking member of the chair of the tax committee can request a local fiscal impact note of the Commissioner of Finance. I would say with some degree of sadness that under at least the last two administrations, there is no requirement as to when they have to come up with the local fiscal impact note. I would say that the degree of seriousness that the Department of Finance has played has paid to answering questions, at least during my tenure as tax chair, was somewhat disappointing. But you may request Representative Lincheski to send a letter to Commissioner Ingeson requesting a local fiscal impact note.
Madam Chair, I can. One has been requested because I've received the letter saying one has been requested, but that was just a couple days ago. That's all I know.
That's my understanding also, Madam Chair, and that we have not received that information back.
All right. Thank you. Any questions for Commissioner Schuweiler? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
There's 5 minutes left for Mr. Babol, Nathan Richmond, and Margaret Donahoe, so I'm going to ask you to constrain your comments to under 2 minutes apiece. Step right up. First come, first serve. We got to move here.
Yep. Nathan Richmond with Seeker County.
Welcome to the committee, sir, and if you'll limit your comments to new points that have not been presented, we'd appreciate it.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chairperson Holberg and committee members. I'm representing the 87 Minnesota County Engineers. I'm the co-chair of their legislative committee, speaking in opposition of the bill. My testimony is in two portions. First portion is general comments. Second portion is a few specifics. Try to avoid going second place on specifics that have already been touched on. What we're talking about here is the Fifth Amendment to the Bill of Rights, last two phrases, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation, 11 words used beautifully by the Founding Fathers. The Bill of Rights is 2 pages of printed material if you print it out. The Constitution of the United States of America is 9 pages if you print it out. Right now, House file here is 9 pages.
And, sir, I'd get your testimony to the bill.
Thank you. MCA understands the legislative strong interest in legislation restricting the use of eminent domain for economic development, which has been characterized as a public agency using eminent domain for transfer of private property from one private interest to another. The county engineer's position is that highway departments and public works projects are for public use and that the current compensation system yields just compensation as intended in the Fifth Amendment. So there's a separation that we're asking that to happen. Specific comments are towards going concern is not clearly defined. Points of access are not clearly defined. In the attorney fee section, asking that shall award be switched to may award. This does move money from road and bridge construction to not road and bridge construction. We have examples from Wisconsin and Florida that have had similar legislation where their right-of-way costs have gone up. Wisconsin, 22%, Florida, 12%. The compensation for going concern section does not clearly define going concern. Has the commissioners in a eminent domain case determining going concern, which is a change from the commissioner's usual directive. determining the value of a business is far more subjective than determining the value of bricks and mortar. It expands the definition of owner from the Bill of Rights definition to a broader definition as in 117.105. Safety was addressed, points of access from an engineering perspective, the points of access in the compensation for loss of access section does not clearly address how anybody would pick the points of access. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I understand that the Minnesota County Engineers Association will continue to work with the legislature to develop a bill that maintains a balance between protecting private property rights and protecting the taxpayers. That concludes my comments. Thank you.
And thank you, sir. I know it's hard to condense down on you. We're living in a time, and I appreciate it. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Donahoe.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Margaret Donahoe. I'm the legislative director for the Minnesota Transportation Alliance. And on behalf of our public and private sector organizations, I'd like to express our concern for provisions in this bill that would increase the cost of right-of-way acquisition, as well as potentially delaying projects and the associated costs with that. We know that right-of-way acquisition is becoming more and more of a cost with highway projects. For example, on the new Highway 212 project just let last year, parcels acquired back in 1991 and 1992 were acquired for about $25,000 an acre. The most recent parcels were acquired at a cost of between $175,000 and $225,000 an acre. More and more of our highway dollars are needed for right-of-way acquisition, with a higher percentage of total project costs going for that purpose. We're also concerned that increased litigation will lead to delays in letting and completing highway projects, and there is certainly a cost to delay in terms of construction costs. Construction inflation is running much higher than the Consumer Price Index, with material costs at a rate of 12.6% more in 2005 than for the same materials in 2004. So we are concerned that implementation of some of the provisions in this bill will lead to more tax dollars needed for the very same highway projects. Basically, our members are concerned about this issue and would respectfully ask that if the legislature believes that additional dollars are needed for the right-of-way acquisition process, that with our very limited dollars in the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, that additional funding be provided to cover those costs. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Donahoe. Any questions? President Earhart?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I heard rumors that Ms. Parker from MnDOT gave an estimate of the cost to MnDOT for this legislation. And I see her in the audience over there, and so I'd like to have her repeat that, or at least answer my question, Madam Chair.
And Representative Earhart, we do have a fiscal note that we're going to look at, and Ms. Parker has asked to testify relative to that, and certainly you can ask that question of her at that time.
That's fine. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Johnson, is there any compelling comments you need to make at this time following the testimony, or are you
Many
prepared to move
chair,
on to the fiscal notes? Or?
Let me just say one thing, although I've got my long list here. this will cost money. Nobody's denying that. I think there's some legitimate disagreement about how much, but this will cost money. And there are going to be some road projects that are going to be more expensive, but I think the fundamental question here is not what's the cheapest way to do this, but who suffers the consequences when a offer that turns out to be too low is made to a property owner who then incurs $20,000 or $50,000 or $200,000 in attorney's fees to quote-unquote win their case, supposedly for the public good. My thought is that the property owner shouldn't suffer those consequences. The public should suffer those consequences. And frankly, this assumption that we just add 20% on means that in every single solitary case, we're lowballing. And I hope that's not the case.
Thank you. Ms. Parker, would you like to come testify to the fiscal note? Welcome to the committee, Ms. Parker. I know you've worked a lot of hours on this and had a lot of discussions with a lot of people, and if you'd like to enlighten the committee, we'd appreciate it.
And thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Betsy Parker from the Department of Transportation. I am going to talk about the fiscal note. Just so that you know, the department is part of the administration and supports the governor's desire to support eminent domain reform. We try to do our best to balance our two obligations of being fair to landowners and taking good care of the taxpayers' money. We have been in conversation with the authors of the bill and the Auto Dealers Association and talking about various things in the bill, so I'm not going to talk about the bill itself, just fiscal issues today. We do have a fiscal note. The fiscal note has two numbers in it, and for those who don't like those two numbers, I have a third number, because as you might imagine, there are many different ways to analyze this. To put this in perspective, I would like to give you a few numbers. Some of these are in the fiscal note, but the fiscal note is long. And so rather than go through it page by page and wait while you read charts, I'm going to summarize some things. In order to do the fiscal note, we looked at 5 years of data from the last 5 years, 01 to 05, and we took an average of those 5 years. During those 5 years, our average per year, we acquired 914 parcels a year. Our 585 of those went through direct purchase, which means we made an offer and either they took it right away or we negotiated and it was settled. 329 of those 914, or a third, went into eminent domain. This is relevant because we would only pay attorney's fees on the parcels that go into eminent domain. Of those that go into eminent domain, on our five-year average, about 150 were settled while they were in the eminent domain process, and 180 of them actually went to hearing and had an award from the commissioners. The bill, the way it's written now, says that we would pay those fees on either the settlements or the awards in the eminent domain process, but it's my understanding that there's been discussion to the effect that the intention is that the 20% and the attorney fee only apply to those that go to award in the eminent domain process, not to settlement. And that has a significant effect on our fiscal note, but because we write fiscal notes to the engrossment that were given by the Department of Finance, and because the bill, even in the fourth engrossment, still includes settlements, that's how we did the fiscal note. Overall, of the parcels that MnDOT either settles or has awarded to landowners at 20% above our offer, that amounts to one-third of all parcels, or roughly 300 of the 900 parcels per year come in excess of 20% above our offer. And there are two reasons for that. One is that from the time when we do the appraisal comes to us and is certified. We make the offer to the landowner. The landowner thinks about it and gets back to us. We put the parcel into quick take. We go to the district court. Time has to elapse. The court appoints the three condemnation court commissioners. They schedule a hearing. They have the hearing. Up over 1 year usually elapses. And in that period of time, especially in the metro area, land values almost always rise noticeably. And so it may be true that there are cases where we do not offer as much as we should, but there are other factors at play in that. One of those factors is that part of the job of the appraiser is to talk to the landowner or the business owner and find out what are the circumstances that justify certain kinds of appraisals. And if the landowner is not forthcoming, then we need additional discussions, which usually happen in settlement, which is why we settle some. In 2005, about 60% of the parcels we acquired were under $50,000 in value, and in 2005 we paid $71 million just for land. That's not any labor, that's just the cost of the land, and we paid an additional $6.5 million in relocation, business reestablishment, and housing supplements. Now, for the fiscal note, we used our five-year average in this fiscal note, and the things that we computed in the fiscal note in order to determine what the additional cost would be were the following. We looked at the number of parcels we have that go into eminent domain and come out as dismissals or awards. We counted the number of dismissals and awards that would be over 20%. We assumed that attorney's fees would be roughly one-third, or 33%, of the difference between MnDOT's offer and the amount of the settlement or award, because that's normally how they're computed. We assumed that there would be expert witness fees for testimony, because we know there are now at the condemnation commissioner's hearings, and we assigned those a value of $150 an hour, because that is what MnDOT pays its own expert witnesses now, and we get them on consultant contracts. We assumed that we would pay appraisal reimbursements for the landowner, because we pay them now up to $1,500 per parcel, and both we and the cities have proposed that commercial and industrial appraisals be reimbursed in the future at $5,000, which is still less than MnDOT itself pays for appraisals of commercial properties. In addition, we included loss of going concern. We do pay loss of going concern now, but not very often. We assumed we would pay it once, one case per year. And then we included the cost of appeals. We assumed we would have 14 appeals per year, which is not very many out of 300 parcels going into eminent domain. And if you look at the fiscal note at the back page, the one that says 10 out of 18, where it says scenario, you'll see that there is a total of $7 million. That is the estimate for what I just told you. Now, a second scenario was done, and the Department of Finance asked that we do this fiscal note in two segments. The first one, assuming these costs on the existing cases that we have now, assuming no additional eminent domain cases and no additional costs for MnDOT labor or Attorney General labor. In the second scenario, we assumed basically the same assumptions about what things would cost, but we assumed that we would put 60% more parcels into eminent domain, because we assume that under the bill there will be no incentive for people to settle, and that it will be better for them financially if they hire a lawyer and go through the entire eminent domain process to award. Given that we would have 60% more eminent domain cases, we included additional MnDOT labor costs and additional Attorney General costs, and that additional work plus the additional cost was assumed to be $10 million for a total of $17 million. Now then, on our own, we did a third scenario. We had a meeting with one of the authors and representatives of the auto dealers about a week or so ago, and they had suggested that our assumptions were too high and that they would like us to look at lower assumptions. So we did an analysis assuming that there would not be a 60% increase in eminent domain parcels, but that there would be a 40% increase. We assumed that attorney's fees would only be 25%, not 33%. We assumed that we would only pay $3,500, not $5,000 for commercial appraisals. We assumed that we would reimburse attorney's fees only for eminent domain awards and not for settlements in the eminent domain process. And we assumed that we would settle 20% more cases than we settle today. So we actually reduced the number that would go into eminent domain. And then we assumed that because we would be settling more and litigating fewer, we assumed that we would have to pay more for the land in order to induce people to settle. Right now we know that we pay 56% more for parcels that go into eminent domain award. So we assumed that we would have to settle them for 57. We chose 60 because that's a round number, 60% more than we offer them for in order to induce settlement and avoid attorney's fees. And when we added all of that up, we got a total of $13 million. So you can take your choice of these numbers. Those are the three scenarios that we looked at.
Thank you, Ms. Parker. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a little confused. Why did you make that second set of assumptions?
Representative Hausman, the Minnesota Auto Dealers representative, asked them to do that.
But is would that be a typical thing?
Ms. Parker.
Madam Chair, Representative Holberg, what is typical today is the analysis that we used in the fiscal note from the Department of Finance, where the total cost is estimated at $7 million. The analysis we did for the using the suggestions from the auto dealers was basically adjusting what we think will happen under the new law and sort of cutting it all back and assuming that we would settle more, but that there will be some more parcels that will go into eminent domain, because if people know they can get attorney's fees, they will probably be inclined to litigate rather than settle. But for purposes of discussion, we assumed that we would actually settle 20% more.
Representative Leader.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Ms. Parker, you don't have in-house MnDOT attorneys, so anytime you get into an appeal or court case, that's the Attorney General's office, and you have to bill your bill back for attorney fees. Is that correct?
Ms. Parker.
Madam Chair, Representative Leader, that is correct.
Thank you. Any additional questions for Ms. Parker? All right. Thank you, Ms. Parker. We are now going to go to amendments. We have 10 of them that I know of. Would anybody like to claim the A64 amendment?
Madam Chair, that's mine, but I'm going to move to A65.
Okay, we will not be taking up the A64 amendment. I do have the A65 amendment next on my list. Representative Earhart, you would like to move that?
I move A65.
A65.
Representative Earhart, you can probably do it from your seat.
Oh, I don't think so.
You just wanted to get up and move around a little bit.
I've got a couple of witnesses, Madam Chair, members. This is about is that...
Could somebody get the bill author a copy of the A65 amendment, please?
I have a copy.
He's going to look over your shoulder until he gets his own.
Oh, Madam Chair, I would like to, I've been informed by many powers that be that we need to make an oral amendment to this. And that would be on line 1.4, a state or local government would be the first part of the sentence, and then we would eliminate official control as the balance of that line. We would eliminate line 1.5, and 1.6 we would eliminate subdivision 4A. So we would have then a state or local government historic preservation.
Okay, members, we'll incorporate that into the A65 amendment.
Thank you.
Representative Earhart, time is very short.
I know that.
So if you'd quickly describe your amendment and very brief testimony.
How come you didn't allow more time, Madam Chair?
Representative Earhart, I think because this bill spent 2 weeks in local government, which I was a part of for the most part, and now we're being told by leadership to move it along. And
other stops, Madam Chair.
How many?
Five others, and then
right,
one
five
other.
Stops. I apologize for it. It's not really how I like to do business, but you occasionally have been told to get bills done by a certain time by the corner as well, and understand the predicament.
Madam Chair, I've never been told that by the chair.
You're
by
lucky.
The corner. But nevertheless, we have here a situation that I have been talking to the author of the bill with over time, and he said, well, let's do it when we get to transportation finance, because you're a member here. And what we are doing here is that briefly, state law allows local government to create historic preservation commissions, and these commissions have the right to designate buildings individually or by district as historic, and that has quite heavy consequences on the owners of those buildings. And so with that, I'm going to, this amendment would, you're all reading it, would say that any historic preservation designation on and after August 1st, 2002, that reduces the fair market value of real property or interferes with it, so forth, constitutes a regulatory taking for which the owner must be paid just compensation. The final sentence says the state or local government may repeal or amend the official control or historic designation, preservation designation to eliminate the adverse impact on the property instead of paying damages. We're not looking for a retroactive fund here. What we would like to be is unburdened from the constraints put on our property. There are a number of properties, and this involves student housing on the University of Minnesota. At the best of my knowledge, it is a number of units over there that were placed on historic designation without the consent or willingness of the properties involved. I am a board member of one of the 501c7 properties, as are these two folks, and I would introduce you to Doug Carlson, who is a board member of one of the nonprofits, and Lynn Swan, who is chair of the Coalition for Nonprofit Student Housing at the University of Minnesota.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you'll provide your brief testimony, we would appreciate it.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Doug Carlson, and I do, as Ron mentioned, I do represent one of the nonprofit student housing groups at the University of Minnesota. And my group was one of the ones whose property was designated historic. I have a copy of the University of the City of Minneapolis report that was published in the process, and we feel that the fact-finding process was flawed. My property was listed with the wrong architect, one that was not the historic one that they thought, and it was listed in good condition, even though it is nothing like the original design that was built in 1915 any longer. We feel as though we went through the appeals process through the State Court of Appeals, which was extremely costly for these nonprofit groups. We feel as though we've been damaged by this designation and we're without compensation. We have higher costs of maintenance to maintain the historic designation, and we have additional regulatory review because of the designation, and we operate without any public subsidy. We now cannot replace our buildings if we needed to, and we cannot change the exteriors of them if we needed to. The services that we would provide to the students are limited because of this designation, and in addition to that, the amount of income that we can get from the buildings is limited. And so I would like to speak on behalf and hope for your positive action on
this. Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Ms. Swan, did you want to add any brief comments to that testimony?
Yes, thank you very much. My name is Lynn Swan. I'm the chairman of the Coalition for Nonprofit Student Housing, which is a group of the house corporations for the sororities and fraternities at the University of Minnesota. We have been told that this would really not have us incurring any higher costs or any greater bureaucracy. When we look at the term you're looking at, which is compensation for regulatory takings, we view this as a unique but still a very serious regulatory taking, since we were not wanting to be designated historic and had to do a great deal of fighting to try and forestall that event. We do know of specific examples where that designation would bring about a great deal more expense. One paternity house in particular had to replace a roof. They were given information by Heritage Preservation Commission that would be $100,000 to replace a slate roof. With a slate roof, there was some ability to back off of that a little and say a fake slate would do for around $40,000, when in fact you can barely see the roof because of dormers on the third floor, and the asphalt roof that would look just fine would have been in the neighborhood of $20,000 or $25,000. So we know that there are financial consequences, and we view this as a unique but still serious regulatory taking.
All right, thank you. Representative Johnson, do you have any comments that you'd like to add?
Madam Chair, I'm fine with this amendment.
All right. Any questions from committee members? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion is the amendment is adopted. Next one in my packet is the A58 amendment. Anybody like to claim the A58 amendment?
Madam Chair, I'll move the A58 amendment.
Representative Magnus moves the A58 amendment. Would you like to explain what it does?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Page 5, page 6. I used the right page myself.
Representative Magnus, we can read the amendment if you want to give us the gist of what it accomplishes.
Madam Chair, basically what happened was we added this section in Ag in the Ag Committee a couple days ago with the understanding we would tighten up the language as part of the discussion that was held on the amendment. What we've done is do that, especially, I would point out, line 1.7, of the amendment, the claim for compensation must be made no later than 1 year after the completion of the project. That was a major issue that we had in adding this section.
Are there any questions on the A58 amendment? All right, is there anybody in the audience who would like to speak in opposition to the A58 amendment? My understanding is this was a clarification of a discussion that occurred in Ag. Seeing none, all those in favor of the A58 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Say nay. The amendment is adopted. Next one on my pile is the A60 amendment. Representative Johnson, did somebody get you a set of amendments so you're ready to...
Yes, I do have that. I just didn't have that one for some reason.
Okay, it's my understanding this is an amendment that you requested.
Yes, Madam Chair.
If you might explain it to the committee.
This goes to one of the issues that I think Mr. Manderscheid raised and has been raised at several different committee meetings with respect to a going concern hearing and the inability of both sides to have some information prior to going into that hearing. This will require that both the property owner and the government have to share their appraisals prior to the actual decision-making on the process. So really what this does, right now the government has to show theirs, but the property owner doesn't. Now they both do.
All right. Is there anybody that's in opposition to the A60 amendment that would like to speak? Any questions? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A60 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. The amendment is adopted. The next one I have is the A061271 amendment.
Madam Chair, that's fine.
Representative Hornstein.
This is a simple amendment that just clarifies the criteria that's something beyond just size for these properties, and my understanding is that you're okay with that, Representative.
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, I support this amendment. It matches us up with the Senate.
Okay. Is there anybody in the audience that would like to speak in opposition to the A061271 amendment? Seeing none, any questions of committee members? Seeing none, Representative Hornstein moves the A061271 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The amendment is adopted. Next amendment that I have is the 1309 amendment.
That's fine, Madam Chair. I'd like to move A061309. Welcome to the committee, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Earhart, I've never seen this members moving to the testifying stand to move amendments. This is something new. So if you'd briefly explain your amendment.
All right, Madam Chair. What this does is provides for adjusting the acquiring authority's last written offer by the rate of appreciation and of similar property in the same city or township if more than 3 months have passed. And in a sense, what it does is say that the last offer before the condemnation commissioners make the award is where the 20 cents will pay off, the 20% will pay off of. And I'd like to call Keith Carlson as a witness, if I may.
Mr. Carlson, very briefly, and we had this discussion in local government, and I think there was concern expressed with the wording of the property class within the same city or township. The example that I gave is that in the city of Lakeville, commercial property along the freeway corridor is accelerating in value far more rapidly than the commercial property in historic downtown Lakeville, 7 miles away, and that this would not be fair. I have some scratch marks on my copy that delete city or township and replace the word with neighborhood. I don't know if that's something you're proposing as well, Representative Earhart. Representative Johnson, do you know what the language in the Senate is on this?
Madam Chair, I'm not certain. Mr. Carlson might know.
Madam Chair,
welcome to the committee, Mr. Carlson.
The language in the 1309 amendment was has adopted in the Senate. If I could address the chair's remarks, I guess the issue is the availability of that information. If you want to go to a readily available source of data that can establish appreciation of property at a finer detail than the city or town level, I would suggest that you use the term unique taxing area, which would be the school district subpart or watershed subpart of the city or town. That's basically the finest detail that's available to the general public. Otherwise, I guess you would be looking at something like the multiple listing service has the source of data to establish value, and I can't guarantee that that's a comprehensive or complete source of such information.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Carlson? All right, thank you. Representative Earhart, what do you want to do with your amendment? Do you want to present it as is, or do you want it amended? Representative Johnson, while they're figuring out what they'd like to do, would you like to give your reaction to this amendment?
Madam Chair, I can accept this amendment. We may want to work on the piece that you have a concern about. This is something that had been brought up many times, and I think it's probably reasonable. I hope everyone remembers this when we try to change the attorney's fee provision even further in a few minutes. But I think this is a good compromise.
Madam Chair,
Representative Earhart.
Representative Johnson, would you be willing to accept this unique taxing area on 1.10 after the same striking city or township?
And Madam Chair, I'm fine with that, but I don't know what it means, so we would still need to work on this piece just to make sure that the chairman and probably Representative Abrams, who probably does understand this, is happy with it.
Well, Representative Abrams, from the description that Mr. Carlson gave of it being a school district or a watershed district, I don't think that in the example that I gave of the city of Lakeville, both downtown and the Target Superstore are located in the same school district and, in fact, in the same watershed as well. So I'm not sure that that accomplishes anything. Do you have any comments about that?
Not necessarily. Madam Chair, I very rarely... I guess I'm not agreeing with Mr. Carlson. I'm not necessarily disagreeing with Mr. Carlson. But I can think of, I would suspect that you would get a far better answer if you talk to Steve Heinz from House Research, who actually works with all these unique taxing jurisdictions, to see what exactly you're getting here when you put in unique taxing jurisdictions. Because when you overlay 370 districts onto 87 counties, onto almost 800 cities, onto Lord knows how many watershed districts. I don't know how many unique taxing jurisdictions you have, and a lot. Very often they will cut through neighborhoods.
Representative Earhart, how about if we make a run at adopting your motion as printed? That way it'll be different from the Senate. It will obviously be a point of discussion, and we can work on some kind of language that might address this issue more effectively. Is there anybody that would like to speak in opposition to the 1309 amendment? Seeing none, Representative Earhart renews his motion to adopt the 1309 amendment. Those in favor say aye. Those opposed, nay.
Nay.
Nay. Motion is not adopted. Next amendment is the A061302 amendment.
Madam Chair, that is mine.
Okay, Representative Hausman moves the 1302 amendment. If you'd like to explain what it does.
In traditional civil law cases, when an injured party wants damages, they must prove them. In this case, the burden has been shifted to the condemning authority to prove that the property owner did not suffer any damages. So this amendment would switch the burden back to the property owner. If a property owner can show that a loss has occurred as a result of the taking, then the owner would be eligible for compensation for this loss.
All right, and I think we heard testimony on this earlier in the opening remarks. Representative Johnson, do you have any comments on the 1302 amendment?
Madam Chair, I don't support this amendment, and the reason is I realize that in the traditional civil law case we do it differently, but I don't think this is the traditional civil law case. This is a case of government confiscating people's property and having to pay just compensation as required by the Constitution. It's a constitutional issue we have here. And I think shifting that burden to be in favor of the property owner and the business owner in this particular case is a good thing. So I don't support the amendment.
All right.
And Madam Chair, I am offering this on behalf of others, and I don't know if anyone wants to come down to speak to this or not.
Representative Hausman, Mr. Mandischheid spoke to this issue in his opening remarks. Is there anybody else in the audience that wants to speak very briefly to this issue? Certainly, very briefly. We're 2 minutes past our committee time.
I want to respond just
Welcome
very
to the
briefly.
Committee. Welcome to the committee and state your name for the record, please.
Mark Mandischheid, Brixton Morgan. This is not a constitutional issue. There are decisions of the Minnesota Supreme Court which have clearly held that just compensation under the Minnesota Constitution does not include loss of going concern. Thus, your decision on loss of going concern is a legislative and not a constitutional decision. If you choose to adopt a statute that provides for loss of going concern, that's your decision. It's something you can do as legislators. It's not a constitutional right.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Any additional comments on Representative Hausman's 1302 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed, nay.
No.
Nay. The motion is not, or the amendment is not adopted. Next item is the A57 amendment. My understanding is this is an issue that Representative Emmer is concerned with. I will move the A57 amendment and ask that Representative Emmer come to the table and briefly explain his amendment.
Morrison County.
Welcome to the committee, Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This amendment is a very site-specific amendment. I have a constituent on Highway 371. If I can use this piece of paper to identify a piece of private property. 371, as it was originally existed, went on this side. 371 was moved to the other side of the private property. There was a lease agreement for a billboard on that private property. When 371 moved to the other side, there's an issue moving the billboard. It's a taking just as much as any private, it's private property. It's a taking. The amendment before you addresses just this one case in order to solve a problem that will likely save everybody involved a lot of time and expense.
Representative Johnson, do you have any comment to the A57 amendment?
Madam Chair, I'm fine with the amendment.
All right. Representative Abrams.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm not fine with it. I was here for pothole night, Representative Earhart. Remember pothole night?
Yep.
Yeah.
And I guess I pledged to myself at that time that we weren't going to do any site-specific signs or roads or anything like that in the future. And just as a matter of legislative philosophy, I think that we ought not do it because we're going to get several hundred amendments dealing with signs and potholes and who knows what else on the floor if we put this in Representative Johnson's bill.
All right. Representative Leader.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, and I would be concerned that there's some federal regulations regarding this, too, because there must be existing right-of-way within the right-of-way limits. And, again, we're dealing with the sign situation that I think has got some other connotations, and I agree with Representative Abrams. We open this one up, we're going to have a Pandora's box.
Representative Emmer.
Madam Chair, Representative Leader, we wouldn't be in front of you if the federal statute or the federal act would be violated by this.
With so signing?
What's that?
Representative Leader.
Oh. Thank you, Madam Chair. There's probably not, there's some regulations. I don't know if you're, I'm not maybe that thoroughly familiar, but I'm a little familiar with some. There's some setback regulations, some depending on the class of roadway, and this is a federal aid road, I presume.
Madam Chair, I do have a representative here, but I don't think we need to take that time. The issue is this. When it got moved across to the other side, it's actually 800 feet from the city limits. It's in the township. It was approved by the township. Subsequently, it was determined there's an annexation issue, which we're just not going to open this whole thing up. Bottom line is it's private property. Signs being moved from one side to the other. It would not be in front of you, Representative, if there were a violation of the without getting into a dissertation on the different laws that apply. This wouldn't be here if that were being violated.
Are there any additional comments? Does anybody in the audience like to speak to this amendment? Any additional questions? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A57 amendment say aye. Those opposed, nay.
No.
Motion's not adopted. I'm sorry, Representative Emery, but you might be able to get creative. You're a really smart guy, so you might be able to figure a way to address this without a site-specific amendment.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for letting me take my best shot.
Right. Next amendment is A061308 amendment. I'm not sure who this belongs to.
What was it? 1308. Oh, that's...
1308 amendment.
1308, Madam Chair, is mine.
Okay. Representative Hausman moves the 1308 amendment. If you'd like to explain your amendment.
This amendment provides an exception to the attorney fee provision for strip takings, acquisitions for road improvements of 50 feet or less of the frontage of a property of up to $25,000 in value, and this is the most common example. And you have to picture this in your mind. Of where this exception would apply is when modernizing an old two-lane highway, which usually have a 66-foot right-of-way extending 33 feet into the property on each side of the center line, assuming the highway runs down the property line. Modern two lanes occupy a 100-foot right-of-way extending 50 feet, the limit provided in the amendment, into the property on each side of the center line, again assuming the highway runs down the property line. The amendment will prevent the cost of highway improvements increasing substantially. While the amount of property and the value of it acquired from any one owner is usually small, the number of properties affected can be quite large. Assuming 100-foot lots, it is possible that 106 different properties and owners would be involved in each mile of road built or rebuilt. If attorney fees have to be paid on each one of those acquisitions, the additional costs can run into the hundreds of thousands of dollars. And again, Madam Chair, I'm offering this for others if anyone would like to come to clarify more or answer questions.
Representative Johnson, do you have any comments on this amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I don't support this amendment either. I was willing to make a change in the attorney's fee piece before, but you guys didn't agree with that. And this one I certainly don't support, because what it does is it exempts out, I would guess, most partial takings by MnDOT. And Representative Leader, you mentioned, you know, the person sitting here earlier was one example, and all examples... Every time MnDOT acts is not an abuse. I agree with that. But I can tell you there are hundreds of examples out there, and if we had 5 hours, I'd bring you all of them.
We don't.
So, we don't. So I did not support this amendment. I think it weakens the bill.
Are there any additional questions? Mr. Carlson, would you like to speak to the A1308 amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Briefly, just to clarify, that the strip takings identified here are for two-lane highways. They're not going to apply to the large projects that MnDOT is engaged in when it's building a four-lane road or larger. It's primarily going to affect counties and to some extent cities in their modernizing of their systems of roads. At every committee, every one of the abuses you've heard have been identified with DOT, not us. I urge the committee to strongly consider adopting this amendment.
All right, thank you. Any questions for Mr. Carlson? All right, thank you very much, Mr. Carlson. Representative Johnson, you and I have had some discussion around this issue of very small amounts of value to the property and the risk of paying large amounts of attorney's fees. And in your discussions with me, you have expressed some willingness to limit the amount of attorney's fees relative to the amount of the award. Is that something that you're still considering?
Yes, Madam Chair, it's something that we can... I figure at some point we're going to have to relook at this issue. I do not think this is the answer because I think it's a large exclusion, but I'm certainly happy, just as I was happy to look at this earlier issue on attorney's fees.
Right,
and
thank
you.
Representative Hausman.
What I would do then is withdraw this amendment because that's, I think, an honest statement of concern on part of the author, and for now I will withdraw this.
Thank you. And it, to my knowledge, last amendment before us is the 1344 amendment. Is there anybody that would like to claim that one? It was passed out within about the last 20 minutes. The A061334.
Oh, that's, yep, they did. I'm sorry.
Madam Chair.
Is that you? Madam Chair.
I could do the going, gone thing.
We had a 1270, anyway, whatever one, and apparently it needed to be redrafted. So apparently this is now 1272. So that is mine.
Okay.
This amendment allows the condemning of property authority access to information from the property owner. This is discovery, so that the condemning authority is able to determine an award for going concern. Without access to this information, there is no way for the condemning authority to quantify what compensation the property owner would be eligible for.
All right, thank
that
you.
Is discovery.
And for clarification purposes, members, this replaces the 1272 amendment.
Okay.
We're not going to hear that one. So, Representative Johnson.
Again, I'm offering that for others if anyone would like to be more clear about this.
Certainly. Mr. Carlson, is this your amendment as well? Where did he go? Oh. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mark Manderscheid. This is an effort in the valuation stage of commission hearings to try and provide some information so that the condemnor may have a fair chance to determine valuation. In tax court proceedings in front of the Minnesota Tax Court for income-producing properties, there is a somewhat comparable type of provision which provides that the taxpayer then, 60 days before the hearing, is to provide information about the property. This is comparable to that in that this would be a business. It would provide information early enough in the proceeding that the condemning authority could hire a business valuation appraiser. Real estate appraisers are generally not competent to determine business value, so you have to have a different appraiser in there, and this is an attempt to try and provide enough information to the condemnor before the hearing on going concern value so that they can make a determination as to what is an appropriate level of damages.
All right, thank you. Any questions for the testifier? Seeing none, Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, I do not support this amendment. In my earlier amendment that I did support that we put on, we required a trading of appraisals at a later stage. I realize that does not go as far as this, but at least I think addresses that issue.
Well, and just from my perspective, it isn't even doesn't even identify income tax returns that are to that business. So the whole exposure
mm-hmm.
of an individual's income for a variety of businesses or holdings would be an issue as well. But are there any questions? All right. Representative Hausman renews her motion that we adopt the A061344 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed, nay.
No.
Nay. The amendment is not adopted. All right. Unless there's somebody hiding an amendment under their chair or in their folder, I'm not aware
very
of any more amendments. Representative Abrams.
Very briefly, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, it should become fairly evident to local units of government that this bill is going to get to the House floor, and there is going to be a vote, and there is going to be a conference committee, and there is going to be a bill. At some point, I hope that the local units of government will come forward with a blight test that is at least as restrictive as current state law, and transition rules that are at least a little bit tighter than if a developer drives by a property on a Sunday afternoon and decides he'd like to do something over there, that that's sufficient in order to trigger grandfather for TIF and eminent domain. I would say that the puck has not passed the goalie yet, but that the goal judge has his finger on the red light and the local units of government are about to be scored on. So I think it's about time that some of the local unit of government organizations, instead of going around the state, trashing the legislature and trashing the bill's authors and saying Armageddon is going to happen if something like this happens, will actually come to the table with serious proposals so that the result will not be unintended but actually intended. But I'm literally at the point looking at blight tests where I want to go with some city managers and say, okay, which building that you currently can condemn, won't you be able to condemn under your blight test? Because I can probably show them a whole swath of buildings that they can condemn under the blight test that they've come forward with.
Representative Hosman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my concern at this point is there was a noble purpose. Sounded good at press conferences, but it's been through a lot of committees, and I don't know how much of this has just been added along the way, but it seems now to have perhaps some extraneous and unintended consequences. For example, I heard Mr. Rolnick arguing that in the case of a public good, and Target Store wasn't one, as I recall he said, that then, of course, we had to be very careful. But when I look, for example, at that section, compensation for loss of access, and I think so much of what is done is for safer roads, traffic lights, for example, or a left turn lane. And if we are overlaying this now on what were really construction projects to safer roads, what have we done to property taxes? What have we done to the cost of road projects that are specifically for safer roads? And I know at some point it's hard to take a look at the whole picture of what you've done, but I'm just believing that perhaps this is a little more like a kind of an out-of-control runaway train than a beginning noble purpose.
Thank you, Representative Hausman. And in a matter of one other item of business that we have to do before we can vote on this bill, we did receive written testimony from Alee G. Ostendorf, and I would like that entered in the record of the meeting as well. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It seems to me one of the functions of this, the Transportation Finance Committee, is to spend more time on the finances of this thing. We heard testimony from MnDOT. Depending on the scenario you're going to pick, it certainly was going to be more costly to MnDOT, and of course they're operating under constraints from the administration, and they're speaking out on the subject. And one of the things that we had under discussion, and I heard from a number of the testifiers, are the attorney's fees. That amendment that was proposed at 1309, which the author said was okay but needed some work, that would be that's going to be a big chunk of the additional costs to MnDOT and other units of government. And I think that that ought to be investigated. And I don't know, the author said he'd work with it, but this committee, who should be watching out for MnDOT's purse, ignores it. And I think that, I hope at least that you will consider some form of restraint, which as you go along here. This is the first time I heard this bill today. I know the rest of you are bored with it.
Yeah, first time for me.
Mm-hmm. And Representative Earhart, I think that most would put me in the camp of trying to get every dime and penny going to cement and tar. And so, you know, I mean, I struggle with this. I don't want a bunch of MnDOT dollars going to pay for attorneys. But when I look at the balance of the rights of individual property owners versus the cost to the taxpayers at large, I think in this particular instance, given some of the risk to property owners, that in general I believe the taxpayers of the state of Minnesota would want the property owners to be fairly compensated and not receive an undue burden of financial costs in trying to hire an attorney and and go through the whole process. Is there more work to do on the bill? Probably. But I think that at this point, for myself personally, I'm willing to commit some additional dollars from MnDOT to assure that the rights of property owners are protected in this process of using eminent domain.
Madam Chair, I'm not disagreeing with that. I'm just saying that when that 20% goes into effect, it makes a lot of difference. And if you got a year and a half, the 2 years time frame in there before the final settlement, in the nature of our world where costs are accelerating so rapidly on right-of-ways, we ought to take another look at that.
And I believe that the bill author is willing to, and as I spoke with him this morning, there were a couple issues that we discussed. This is an honorable man in front of us, and I believe that he will continue to work on these issues, and there'll be continued changes to this bill as it moves forward. Are there additional questions? Representative Leader.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree with the author that we've had problems with taking eminent domain and using it for private use, but I think we ended up bashing MnDOT. That's all I can see is we've done in here, and increased the cost to taxpayers. My concern is, a few years ago, we passed bills or statutes in here that provides that MnDOT can't use their own appraisers. Those are all contract appraisers. Now, we're blaming MnDOT, and they're hiring those appraisers. I think we tied their hands, because supposedly they're lowballing, apparently, and it certainly sounds like it, but I think we're really punishing the wrong group in here, and I'm real concerned the impact we're going to have, not on MnDOT, we're going to have it on cities and counties and townships, and anybody that's ever worked with eminent domain certainly is aware of that, and I can appreciate the problem. There have been problems with individual awards, apparently, but they also had, and they still have, a recourse. They can go to the courts, and most of these have gone to the courts, and they've been appealed, and they've been settled. Now we're bypassing the courts, basically, in my opinion, by what we're doing in this. And if I know a little bit about contract law, and I'm not an attorney, but we've also come in here where we're going to pay awards for lost business or anything else. And in contracts, when we have them on highway, if we put a penalty in for loss of time and overtime, we're also should be recognized if there's any profit, that we should get it back to wherever the contracting agency is. And that we haven't addressed. So there's some real problems with this that I certainly agree that the author is trying to do something, and I think his intention started out to protect the private individual, but that's blossomed into, like they say, a Christmas yard. It's not your fault. But we've seen it coming through the committee, and I think we've gone way beyond what the intent of the author was.
Thank you, Representative Leader. Any additional comments?
Madam Chair, can I just say one thing and then let the vote?
Certainly, Representative John.
Just with respect to the bill getting too big, and it is still shorter than the U.S. Constitution, by the way. You guys didn't pass our test. It's not a runaway train. There have been a few pieces added, but frankly, not much. Most of the changes that have been made in committee have been to address concerns that have been raised by government entities that I thought were legitimate concerns. And there are still some of those in here that we'll continue to work on. But I strongly disagree that it goes too far or it's too broad. Everything in here is trying to address something that is legitimate. But it's still a work in progress.
Thank you. If there are no other comments or questions, I would renew my motion that House File 2846, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay.
No.
The motion is adopted. And members, my apologies for keeping you here late. You know I like to be punctual, but I didn't want to come back at 9 o'clock. So thank you very much for that. Meeting's adjourned.